Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute long, true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robarts.
Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our theme for this show is Oops! We have stories of mistakes, narrow escapes, and lucky breaks.
Arctic Entries has been lucky enough to hear from many, many storytellers who were born and raised in Alaska. Our first storyteller is one of those lucky ones.
Natasha von Imhoff has been an Alaskan her whole life. She enjoys hiking flat top with her kids and catching king salmon.
Here she is, live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
So my husband Rudy and I, we've been married for 20 years. And 20 years is long enough to kind of learn the idiosyncrasies of your significant other. And for me, I am very organized, as Matt was saying. My husband actually would call that OCD. There's a little bit of truth to that. There's a saying, a place for everything, everything in its place. For me, I like to have the coats hung up. I like to have the shoes put aligned. I like the beds made. I like the dishes done at the sink at night. And when I was telling my husband about this opportunity to speak at Arctic Entries, he's like, oh, be sure to include that you have to be at the airport 2 hours early. You have to be at the movies 30 minutes before the previews even start. And for you, on time is late. I'm like, okay. There's a little truth to that. That's fair. When I was younger, my family actually called me the muscle. And not because of my fit physique, but because sometimes I can be a little tense and uptight. But to my husband's credit, he actually accommodates some of my neuroses, and he helps me with the dishes every night. And Rudy, honey, thank you. I appreciate that. So on with the story. So picture a beautiful sunny day in southeast Alaska. We're about 70 miles north of Juneau. Rudy and I are on a double date with our friends John and Tessa. We're in a little 20-foot dory boat, and we're king salmon fishing under the sun. So we spent all day salmon fishing, laughing, joking. It was a beautiful two-day weekend. We're supposed to kind of be romantic, kind of loosen up, chill out, relax, the whole thing. So after a full day of fishing, we find ourselves a cove, just a random cove, and anchor up the boat. And we take the little rowboat to shore, and we build a fire, and we roast hot dogs and marshmallows and drink beer. It's a great evening. And then it's evening, so about 10, 11 o'clock at night, it's time to go to bed. It's been a really long day. So John and Tessa take the rowboat back to the dory boat. That's where they're sleeping. And Rudy and I, we're going to sleep in the tent on the beach. So we're tidying up, and I turn to Rudy, and I said, well, how do you want to put out the fire? And he's like, it's fine. I'm like, oh, that goes against my OCD. If it was up to me, we would take a 5-gallon bucket of water and completely douse that fire. It would be an ash slurry, a fire soup, if you will. But no. This weekend, I'm supposed to be relaxed, Natasha. Laid back, Natasha. Go with the flow, Natasha. So Rudy must have seen the conflict on my face because he gently lays his hand on my arm and says, honey, I'll tell you what. How about I pee on the fire? And I thought, really? Well, how much you got? And he's like, I got quite a bit. I've had a few beers tonight. And I said, okay, let's go for it. So he starts peeing on the fire, and I got a big stick, and I'm stirring it. And he over here, and he pees on the fire, and I got a big stick, and I'm stirring it. And it's a big smelly, you know, steam bath. Oh. And he's done, you know. And I look down, I thought, there's a few embers, but okay, you know, hey, it's go with it. And if he's good with it, I'm good with it. So we go to bed, fall asleep. A couple hours later, I wake up, and I'm just kind of listening to the night sounds, and I'm like, huh, something sounds kind of funny. So I said, I'm kind of curious. I'll take a look. So I unzip the fly of the tent, and I look outside, and I see tiny little flames at the edge of long blades of grass, tiny little flames at the edges of pieces of driftwood. It's like
A fire fairy had come with her wand and went ding, 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 ding. And my first thought was, oh, that is so pretty. And then I kind of looked a little harder and I blinked a little bit and I was like, wait a second. There's like flames about 50 feet beyond our fire pit and some of them are in large clumps. The beach is on fire. So I run back to the tent, Rudy, 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 the beach is on fire. And he's like, okay. So we put on our boots and we look around, what do we have? We have two Nalgene bottles and a titanium pot. Go! So we run down to the beach and it is low tide. Low tide. It is like 70 feet down this hill. And so we're running down the hill and we're going, John, Tessa, wake up! Because they're in the boat right there in the cove. And so we get down there and Rudy puts the titanium pot into the water and I take the two Nalgene bottles and I bend down and blub, 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 blub. Do you know how long it takes to fill up Nalgene bottles when you're in a hurry? So we run back up and we douse the water out, and we douse the flames. And we're like, one flame down, 99 more to go. And at that point, John had tested, they had joined us, and so John's got this big fire extinguisher, and he goes, shh, and it works great on a 5-foot by 5-foot area. So we're like, we gotta keep doing this. So for about 30 minutes, we're running back and forth, and we're kicking it, and we're stomping it, and we're dousing it. And after about 30 minutes, we take a pause, and we're making progress. It's not getting any worse. We're like, whew. And then we kind of like look at each other. We're all pretty much naked. And we're like, please, let's not have a GoPro or an iPhone or anything. So for the next 45 minutes, we keep going. We're dousing and the whole thing. And we put it out. And we're cleaning up, ready to go to bed for the second time. And Tessa kind of turns to Rudy and I and said, why didn't you put the fire out in the first place? And Rudy and I are like, Rudy's like, I peed on it. And I was like, I stirred it. Clearly not enough. So from that night on, I was the official fire marshal for the family. Until about 2 years later, we have the fateful kitchen grease fire. And so what happens when you have a grease fire? You generally put a lid on it. Oh no, not me. I wanted the fire out of the kitchen. So what do? I carry a flaming bowl of grease fire through the living room towards the balcony so I can throw it out into the snow. And what does one do when they're faced with a big flaming ball of grease? They flinch. And that's exactly what I did. And a big ball of grease leapt over the side of the pot and completely singed the carpet. And Rudy looks at me and he's standing right side to me and he's like, we're even.
You just heard Natasha von Imhoff, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short, 7-minute stories about their lives. Our theme for this show is Oops.
Mike Schiffer has lived in Alaska for more than 45 years. He's taken his share of long drives between Alaska and the lower 48. Here's just one of those experiences.
Okay, so it's 1981. I'm 21 years old. I'm finishing my junior year at Gonzaga University, and props to Gonzaga, yeah. And I'm making the decision that I'm going to drive the Alcan alone back to Anchorage. So I've got a 74 Mustang, and I do the things I think I need to do to get it ready to go. You know, I got plastic covers for the headlights so the rocks wouldn't break them. I got a deflector so rocks wouldn't break the windshield. I aired up the tires. Shoot, I even checked the spare tire to make sure that it was ready to go. So I got it all set up, took off, and I was making really good progress down the highway. I knew it was going to take me a few days, and was fighting a little bit of rain and weather and so forth, but I was cruising along doing really good. In those days, the road was pretty rocky. It was dirt, basically, and I was dealing with a lot of mud and the washboardy kind of thing. But I was still getting up to like 60 miles an hour. And that's when I saw the construction zone sign. And for those of you, to give you an idea, the construction zone is just like on the Kenai. You know, you see that area of intense work, the heavy equipment going around, and then you've got miles and miles of warnings to drive slowly. So I've got this construction site, miles and miles of drive slowly. In fact, it was almost 100 miles that I was driving slowly, trying to make my way down the Alcan. I finally think that I've passed the construction zone, I'm ready to take off, and in a bit of frustration, I hit the gas and took off. So the ditch they dug across the road was probably not that big when they dug it, but with all the rain and the snow melt and it's springtime, it had widened considerably. So I'll own some responsibility, and I may have hit it a little too fast. When I landed on the other side, I bounced off the roof of the car. Needless to say, I was worried. I was scared. So I took my foot off the gas, slowed down, and I'm expecting to hear, you know, the thump, thump, thump of a broken or flat tire or some sort of broken tailpipe noise, something. I don't hear anything. Car sounds like it's running perfect. So I think I've dodged a bullet, and I hit the gas again. And just as quick as I hit the gas, I see that temperature needle in the car start to rise up rather rapidly into the red zone. And I think, now I'm in trouble. Pull to the side of the road, get out of the car, and I hear steam coming out of the engine. And I look under the car, and sure enough, there's radiator fluid pouring out of the bottom of the car. And then I looked around and realized I was smack dab in the middle of nowhere. No one knew where I was. I had no one there to support me in what I was doing. I didn't know how I was going to get out of this mess. I didn't know where I was going to find a mechanic. I didn't know what it was going to cost me to try and fix my car. I was starting to panic, to put it mildly. And in the distance, I saw a pickup truck with a camper coming down the road towards me. And he slowed down and pulled in front of me and stopped. And I noticed it had Yukon Territory license plates. Now, I swear to God, this guy, when he got out of the car and walked around the corner, he looked exactly like Rick Moranis from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, or Second City TV's Great White North with the jokes they made about the Canadians back then. And he comes over and he looks under my car, and in the strongest Canadian accent, he says, "Yeah, looks like you got a hole in your rad there, eh?" And I had the most observant Canadian helping me out at that moment. And he says to me, "You're going to need to get that fixed." So I relied on the unwritten rule of the Alcan that says you help each other out. You help the drivers out on the road. And I said, "Yeah, you're right. Do you think I could get a ride down the road to get some help?" And he says, "No, can't do that." And he turns around and walks back to his pickup truck. And I think the guy's going to leave me here. And so he says, "Yeah, this here's a company truck, don't you know, and can't have riders in it." And he reaches up and pulls down the tailgate. So that was probably the first time I thought of the old adage of stranger danger. What is he going to do, put me in the back of his pickup? Wait. But fortunately, as the tailgate dropped, I saw all these tools in the back of his truck. There was even a welding machine in there. He hands me a bucket, and he says, "Why don't you go back to that ditch and get some water?" So I take the bucket, go to the ditch, come back, and he's got the radiator out of the car already, slant on the side of the road. I can see the hole in the radiator. It's right there. And he's standing there smoking a cigarette. And I said, "So do you think we can fix it?" And he pauses for a moment and says, "Well, I got no solder. I can't fix a rad without lead solder. So I think we're stuck again." And then he says, "Do you have a spare tire?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And I went to get the spare tire out. And as I'm getting the spare tire out, I turn around, and he's standing right next to me, and he whips out a pocket knife. Again, stranger danger's coming to mind. And before I can say anything, he's prying those little lead balancing weights off of the rim of my tire. And I watch him take that back to the truck, and he starts pounding on it a little bit. Next thing I know, he asks me, "So, you got any change?" And I reached in my pockets and pulled out a few coins, and he took a quarter, held it over the hole in the radiator, and he says, "Well, that'll do it." And he, quick as could be, he welded that quarter onto the hole of the radiator and then used the lead to seal it up. And it was like I had a regular Canadian Mr. Fix-It. So he says, "Go ahead." And a few minutes later, he pops it into the car, and he says, "Let's start her up and see if she leaks." So I fired it up. We looked under the car. No leaks. I was completely amazed. My Canadian MacGyver had solved my problems. And I didn't know what to say. So I said, what do I owe you? And he thinks for a minute, and he says, you know, nothing. I tell you what, though, the next time you see someone in trouble and you think you can help them, you should do it. And it took me a few years before I realized what he meant by that. When I asked for help, I had wanted a ride. But what he had realized is I needed my radiator fixed. And, you know, I sold that car with the radiator and the quarter still in the radiator. And to this day, that's the best deal I've ever gotten on a quarter.
That was Mike Schiffer, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. We're hearing stories of mistakes, lucky breaks, and narrow escapes.
Our next storyteller, David Popiel, is an architect here in Anchorage. He'll tell us about a run-in with some poor design and a very narrow escape.
It was the summer of 2003, and I just graduated from college, and I got a job working with a local contractor in town. And it was a fine job, but at that point in my life, my priorities were ultimate frisbee and rock climbing. And so the job was fine, but it put gas in my car and it got me where I wanted to go to climb and play frisbee. And so I was pretty much just happy to be there. And so the company consisted of three people. There was Ken, who was the boss, and he, for reasons unknown, always carried around a small cooler filled with Dr. Pepper. I don't know why. And there was Paul. He was a journeyman carpenter, and he was a man of few words. And then there was me, who was the dumb end of the tape. And the big job for the summer was renovating a old 10-story brick building in downtown St. Louis. There was turning it into lofts, and there was a lot of wall framing and drywalling to be done. And so since I was the low man on the totem pole, my job was basically to carry all that drywall from the loading dock to whatever floor we were working on. And the way that I did that was using a freight elevator. And it was the freight elevator that I'm certain came with the building, turn of the century. And calling it a freight elevator is way too generous a term. This was like a crappy human-sized chicken coop that magically ascended and descended. It was terrible. There was three walls that made a chain link, old chain link, and then the side that you got on and off was just open. There was no barrier, there was no safety, nothing. It was just you and your free will keeping you alive when you were in the elevator. And there was a big cross beam at the top where an actual piece of rope was connected, went up and down, and The openings on the floor that you got on and off this thing were in the same spirit as the elevator. They were just open. It was a brick arch and then space. And it was kind of convenient in a way, because if you were on the fourth floor, you could kind of peek, like lean into the shaft and like look up, look down. Oh, it looks like the elevator's on the second floor. I guess I'll take the stairs. But it was super dangerous. It was a huge lawsuit just waiting to happen, I'm sure. And it was also the coolest thing I had ever seen. I loved all of it. It was so much fun. Something happened earlier than I should have kind of cued me in as to maybe how dangerous the situation was. One of the early adopter tenants, their dog got loose and went wandering around, and it smelled something interesting, maybe, and it got over to the elevator, poked its head in, and probably thought that ground was closer than it was. And 2 weeks later, Paul and I go down to the bottom of the elevator shaft, and this is after the whole thing starts to smell bad, and we find our little guy. He didn't make it. So that's really sets the tone there. So back to work. I'm right. It's good. So it's the middle of the morning one day, and I'm on my second or third run, and I get down to the loading dock, I grab a sheet of drywall, and these are big sheets, it's 4x8, 60 pounds, pick it up, and maneuver it into the elevator, and I stand it up on end, and I just lean it against the crossbeam. And then I go back and grab maybe 8-9 more sheets, fill the whole elevator up, and then I snuggle in to the elevator itself, and I hit the lever to make it go up. And one more thing about it, the way that this thing was controlled was it was controlled by a lever, and it looked like the hands on a clock. And if you pushed it all the way back to 9, the elevator would go up. If you went to 3, it would go down. And if you pushed it past 9 or past 3, it would lock in place, and the elevator would keep going up or down until either you disengaged it or you hit something. So I sneak in there, and I push it all the way back to 9. I get it going. I get up to the 7th floor. I disengage the lever at just the right moment because this elevator is a piece of crap, and it doesn't stop. It just floats slowly to a stop. And I disengage just at the right moment and get floors leveled up with the elevator floor. I start taking the drywall off. I get all the sheets off, and I get to the last one. And for reasons unknown, I pick that last sheet of drywall up just by the bottom, and I start walking back out of the elevator. And I get halfway out of the elevator, and a couple things happen in quick succession. The first thing is that the top edge of that drywall slides off the crossbeam and falls to the floor. And when it does, it kicks out the front edge, hits me in the shins, and lays me down right on top of that sheet of drywall. Perhaps most importantly, on its way down, that sheet hit the lever, pushed it all the way back past 9, and locked the whole, or got the whole thing, contraption, me, the sheet of drywall, half in, half out, locked in the up position, heading right for that brick arch. And I remember thinking to myself, ow, my shins hurt. And then I thought, why am I lying down? And then I thought, I feel like I'm floating. Floating's bad. And in a moment of awareness that I'm really proud of to this day, I realize what's happening, and I just put both hands on the sheet of drywall, and I push myself out of the elevator. And I slide off the edge of the sheet of drywall, and I land on my feet. Because by the time all that stuff had happened, and the lever had engaged, and I was laying down, the elevator had gone up probably 4 feet, and it was just picking up speed. And I slide off the edge of the drywall, and I look up just in time to see the elevator disappear up the shaft, the drywall hit that brick arch and get sheared in half, and everything just keeps going up. The half sheet of drywall hangs on for maybe a couple more feet, then it rips completely off, and it just comes zipping down the just past the opening, and then hits the bottom of the shaft and breaks into a million pieces. I look up a little bit. Elevator starts making some more noise. Volume rises, and then, and it hits the top of the shaft. I think I know what just happened. And so I walk down the hall, and I get Ken and Paul, and I bring them back, and I tell them the story. And Paul kind of looks at me. He walks over to the elevator. He pokes his head in. He looks down, sees the drywall. He looks up, sees the elevator. He looks at me, and he goes, man. Ken doesn't say anything. He just kind of rubs his jaw. He digs into his pocket and he grabs $20. He opens his cooler and he grabs a Dr. Pepper. And he hands them both to me and he says, why don't you take a long lunch?
You just heard from David Popiel. And this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Arctic Entries has a great partner program called StoryWorks Alaska.
StoryWorks conducts workshops in Anchorage high schools throughout the year, and some of those students make their way to our show.
Hiroja Jawara was born in Annapolis, Maryland, and moved to Alaska when she was 11. She's currently a sophomore at Diamond High.
Okay, so before I begin my story, there's two things I really have to tell you. First, as a child, I was super horrible. You'd probably tell your kids to run away from me. But I tell you that so you understand who I was when I tell you my story. The second thing I have to tell you is, I think I've changed from that child. But I tell you that so you don't judge my character. Okay. So it was a bright sunny day in Annapolis, Maryland, and my mom was getting ready to go to a party. And being the woman she is, she was like, I'm going to take a snack. And this time, her choice was to take pecans. See, I'd never heard of pecans, so I was super curious. But I just stood there and watched her as she opened the bag of nuts and poured it into the foil bowl. And I was just like, oh, these look cool, Mom, you know? I was like, yeah. But then she sets the bowl outside so they could roast under the sun because it was a super hot day. And she says, don't touch the pecans. And I was like, yeah, of course, Mom. Yeah. But on the inside, I was like, no. I was going to get these nuts even if it killed me. I mean, it almost did kill me, but almost doesn't count, right? So she goes back inside, and I follow her, and she says, okay, go outside on the lawn so I can, like, look out from my bedroom window time to check up on you. So she goes up the stairs, and she's going to go get my brothers ready. And, you know, I follow her, and we go towards the door, and all of a sudden, she goes up the stairs, and I act like I'm going out the door, and all of a sudden, zoom, right back through the house, and I'm in the backyard now. And there's the foil bowl. See, like, a good child would just walk away, be like, no. But I was not that child. And, I mean, you could kind of, like, hear the angels sing when you saw that bowl. Because, like, it was shining from the sun's rays, and I was so excited. So I get a stool, because I was super short, and I put it by the rail. And I reach up into the bowl, and I got my pecans. And I was super happy. So I run right back to the house, and now I'm on the front lawn. So, I mean, technically, I followed my mom's direction, which was to go to the front lawn, just not when she told me to do it. So, doesn't matter. So, I was sitting there, and, you know, I'm eating my pecans, and I'm about halfway through my handful, and I'm like, something doesn't feel right. I feel a little tingly. But I wasn't the sharpest tool in the tool shed, and I was like, you know, this is the tingling that happens when you try new foods, you know? Like, you know, parents are like, hey, try your vegetables. Try something new. This is normal. I was amped. I was like, ooh, tingly. So I sit there, and I keep eating. And the handful finishes. I'm like, I had to have more. So I run back through the house. I get my handful back on the lawn. And, you know, I feel good. So I take my flip-flops off, and I'm sitting there on the lawn, and my sister's bus pulls up, and she gets off with her friends. And, you know, they walk up to me, and they're just looking at me super weird, and they surround me, and I'm just like, teenagers are weird. But, you know, I kind of ignore them. But then my sister looks directly at me, and she goes, what the heck is wrong with your face? And I was like, oh my gosh, she just called me ugly in front of all her friends. Like, how rude, right? So, you know, I ignore her. And then her friends leave, and she goes into the house. So I follow her, because I was that annoying little sister. But then halfway up the stairs, I start to feel a little nauseous and dizzy. But, you know, I kind of ignored it. So I just sit on the couch in the living room. And that's when she busts out her phone and just starts taking pictures of me. And I was like, what the heck, dude? So, you know, I'm looking down while I'm sitting on the couch, and then that's when my mom and my little brother come downstairs, and my brother jumps on my lap, and, you know, I'm still looking down, and my mom goes to the backyard to check her pecans. And so my brother's playing around, and then he yanks one of my ponytails, and I look up at him. We make eye contact, and all of a sudden, and he runs away crying. And I was like, oh my God, my family thinks I'm hideous. What am I going to do? But I just sit there. And my mom comes in, same reaction, like, what is this creature that I gave birth to? I'm just like, oh my God. And she gives me a mirror, and I look at myself, and I wanted to scream. My eyes were like bright red, it's like bloodshot, and they were swollen, and I looked like a raccoon. And I had these weird bumps all over my face. And, I mean, it looked kind of cool. I mean, I was 8. It was like, ooh, connect the dots. But at the same time, it was really scary. So I was like, oh, something's kind of wrong here. So then my dad comes, and he takes me. We all get in the car, and we drive off to the hospital. And we get in, and he carries me in. And I was freaked out because I'm absolutely terrified of hospitals. Like, I don't know why. I just am. So I'm in his arms, he's carrying me, and my dad's almost 7 foot, so I wanted to jump, but it would be like jumping off a cliff and I would die, so I didn't. But the main reason I kind of stayed calm was because it was getting super hard to breathe. So we walk in, and all I remember is hearing a nurse say, okay, get her into her room, stat, and then it all went black. The next thing I remember is I could barely open my eyes, but I saw I was in a white room, and there were white lights, and it looked like heaven. I swear, it looked like in the movies, like heaven, whoa. But then I was like, going back to what I told you before I began my story, I wasn't the best child. There's no way that I was in heaven. So then I hear a man's voice call my name, and I know what you're thinking. God. But no, it was actually the doctor, and I find that out after I pass out again and then wake up. So now I'm awake, and I can fully open my eyes, and I see that I'm in a white hospital room, and I'm in a bed, and to my right is my sister, and she's still taking pictures of me. It was kind of weird, but then I see my siblings in the back sleeping, and my parents are talking to the doctor. Then the doctor comes up to me, and he starts asking me, like, a bunch of questions, and I'm just like, dude, I just got back from the dead. Can you chill? It was weird. So he goes, Hiroja, you had anaphylactic shock. And I was like, I was 8. I didn't know what that means. So in my head, I was like, Annabelle, what are you talking about? But I just sit there, and he says, well, it looks like you're allergic to pecans from our tests. And I was like, oh, pecans, you know? But I couldn't talk because my throat was too dry. So my mom butts in, and she's like, oh, she didn't eat any pecans, but I had some around, and she was there. And the doctor's like, oh, it could have been from the smell of the pecans. So my mom's like, oh, my God, I almost killed my baby. And then she walks over to me, and I drink some water, and I tell her, like, Mom, sorry, I ate the pecans. And when she walks towards me, I'm just like, oh, God, she's going to kill me. But it won't matter because I'm already in the hospital anyways. And she's just like, oh, I'm so sorry. And, you know, we all kind of laughed that off. But now, like, when I was getting ready for my story, I looked back through my medical records. And from when I was 8 to now when I'm 15, I've had about 200 allergic reactions. And I know, it's kind of funny, though. But and it's the best thing about that pecan experience is that now, every time I go to the doctor's office and it's super quiet, I just had to be like, it wasn't the pecans.
That was Hiroja Jawara, live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts. This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour, and our theme for this show is Oops.
Each month, the Arctic Entries Storyboard works with 7 people to share their stories. Anyone may pitch a story for one of our live shows. More on that at arcticentries.com.
With big hair, a big mouth, and a big laugh, our next storyteller hails from New Jersey. Here's Deanna Benedetti.
So I need to preface this with a few things. 1, I was 17. 2, I was in New Jersey. And 3, I had a bit of a temper problem. And I had just broken up with my high school boyfriend, Jamie. And he was beautiful. He looked like a Roman god. He had chest hair at 17, and that's just not that normal. So I do what anybody would do, and I go to a party to get over it. And it just so happens to be in the backyard of a house whose backyard is facing Jamie's. And it's kind of like across a road, but the road is made of water because it's a canal, about the length of half of a football field. So I'm kind of feeling sorry for myself, and I'm sitting in the backyard, and I'm looking across the water at his backyard. And I see the sailboat that's sitting there that my dad had bought me, that I had spent some time teaching Jamie to sail on. And my dad had bought it with the explicit instruction that we could dock it at Jamie's house so long as he knew he was in charge of the safekeeping of the sailboat. So I'm watching it bobbing in the water, and I'm thinking about all the times I had when I was 17. And I see some shadowy figures in the backyard, and my friends are kind of behind me. They're doing their thing that you do when you're 17, and you're not supposed to be doing that. And I see these shadowy figures, and I'm like, no, that's Jamie. I know that figure. And I see definitely a female figure, and I'm like, no, no. My friends are like, is that Jamie? What is going on? And they're egging me on, and they're just like kind of getting me going. And I see this female figure, and they're getting acquainted. And I know that because I can see that much. And my friends are like, what are you going to do? So I feel like this heat building up inside of me, and I feel it like coming up through my chest and into my head and into my ears. It's kind of some ringing going on. And they get up, and they go inside, and the lights go out. And I'm like, oh, God, no, no. This has just been a couple days since we broke up. So I walk past all my friends who are now laughing at me, because they're good friends. And I go into the garage where some other people are hanging out, and I pick up a hammer. And I turn around, and I walk past my friends, and I don't look at them. My head's down. And I slink into the canal, fully clothed. And I grew up sailing, and you would think I could swim. I can't, not well. So I get into the water, and I put the hammer in my teeth, like I'm in Mission Impossible. And I start doggy paddling across the water, and I'm splashing around, and I make it, and I'm exhausted, and I'm out of breath, and there's water in my mouth, and I climb onto the dock, and I have the hammer in my hand, and my friends are like, Deanna. And you just laughed at me. So I climb aboard my boat, and I punch a hole in the hull. And the boat starts taking on water, and I'm like afraid, and it's a tiny boat. And I'm afraid, and I just have like all these visions of three or four times I saw Titanic in the movie theater. And I think it's gonna pull me under. So I jump off. I throw the hammer, and I jump off the boat. And I make a tremendous like splash. And I don't know how nobody heard me in the house. It's because they were busy. And I doggy paddle back across the water. And I get out, and I'm out of breath. And my friends are like, oh, my God. What did you just do? And the boat's sinking. And I was like, it's time for me to go home. So I'm a little embarrassed, and I go home, and I go to bed, and the next morning I get up, and I'm kind of like, I really did that. And my phone rings, and it's Jamie, and he's like, oh my God, I don't know how to tell you this, but your boat sunk. And I went, what? My dad is gonna kill you. And what's weird is that Jamie was terrified of my father. Jamie was like 6 foot tall, and my dad was 5'4". So it made no sense. But I said, my dad is going to kill you. And he said, I talked to my dad, and he'll write you a check. And I'm like, oh, that sounds fair. That sounds fair. So he bought the boat for $4,000. So he's like, just come over, pick up the check. So I come over, I pick up the check for $4,000. His dad is looking horrified. So I come home. My dad is sitting at the kitchen table reading a book. And I walk in, and I'm like, Dad, I have to tell you something. And I'm real nervous. So I walk in, and I sit down, and I'm like, Dad, I was at this house party that I probably shouldn't have been at. And I saw Jamie across the canal with another girl, and you know, I was pretty upset, so I did some things. In fact, I like sunk my own boat that you bought me, but I got a check for it. And my dad was like, so you have a check? So I like pushed the check across the table, and my dad opens it up, and he's like, $4,000? And I said, yeah. My dad goes, I bought the boat for $2,800. And I said, I know. And he says, so I'll just take the $2,800 and you just take the rest? And I was like, that sounds really fair. And I was so worried that he was going to yell at me. So he stands up and he walks out of the kitchen, shaking his head, turns around, walks back in, puts his hand on my shoulder and says, I'm really proud of you. Thank you.
That was Deanna Benedetti on the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
Every once in a while, Arctic Entries goes on the road. For example, the Talkeetna Historical Society invites us to host workshops.
Steve Durr was a storyteller at one of our Talkeetna shows, and he was kind enough to drive down to Anchorage to tell his story at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
So it was 1968. My dad resigned his professorship at Syracuse University, came home, said, Carol, kids, get in the car, we're going to Alaska. We're going to live in the wilderness. So we headed north to Lake Iliamna. And, about a year later, due to some unforeseen circumstances combined with some severe miscalculations, we were destitute, homeless, and just a band of gypsies. And we finally washed up on a little lake north of Talkeetna, up in what's known as the Chase area along the railroad. It's all roadless up there. And we began to rebuild our lives. Built a cabin for my parents and my siblings, two preteens and a six-year-old. I was 20 at that time. And with the help of some of my high school buddies who came north for adventure as well, we got that done and started to get back on our feet until September of 1973, when the cabin, my parents' cabin, caught fire and burned to the ground. And we tried to fight it, but we were unprepared. We were just really chichacos. We didn't have fire extinguishers. The buckets we had were in the house. So there we are fighting this thing, and it's just mind-blowing how a cabin will burn, glorified kindling. And it's getting dark, and out of the night sky comes a float plane. And we know this plane. It was Don Sheldon, who, yes, you guys know that name. He's the most famous pilot in Alaska at the time, probably still is. But he was our float plane pilot whenever we could get a plane in to fly freight in. And he circles the lake and comes in and lands. And it's really dark, but of course the cabin is glowing pretty bright. And there was a rubber raft out in the middle of the lake, one of those little yellow ones, two-person raft that we'd gotten for the kids, and it was illuminated. So he comes in for a landing, comes over to the dock, taxis in, gets out on the float as he's coming in. And my dad steps out on the dock and says, well, did you bring the marshmallows? Yeah, that's typical Alaska macho stuff. But Don was serious. He goes, oh, is anybody hurt? Is everybody okay? That's the way he talked. He had kind of a exaggerated Midwestern accent. And we said, we're all right. He says, okay, well, I got to get going because it's going to be too dark to land in Talkeetna. We said, well, how do you do that? And he said, well, we're a fly-by-night operation anyway. I'll be back in a couple of days. So a couple of days later, he came back in and, what are you going to do? Well, we're going to rebuild. We got some neighbors have come by, and we're going to pitch in and build another cabin. He says, oh, well, you're going to need a moose to feed all these guys. And you're not going to get one around here with all the chainsaws and the hammers going on. I'll fly somebody out, and we'll get one. So, yeah, that was me. I got in the plane with Don, and we took off across the Susitna Valley to the west side over by the Alaska Range. And on the way, he's telling me, he says, you want to get a nice, fat, barren cow. And he told me that a couple of times. A nice, fat, barren cow. She'll have that needle on the backbone, and it's the best. So he picks out a little lake, typical lake for the Sioux Valley, swamp on both ends, and a little forest on each side. And the lake was kind of shaped like a mitten like that. I set up my camp where the thumb meets the hand. My camp, yeah. It was like a Value Village two-person orange pup tent that Boy Scouts would be embarrassed to sleep in. So I set up camp, and it's already getting late, so I walk down the thumb, which is like a little bay. It's about 50 yards, and then 20, 30 yards across a beaver dam and back up towards the main end of the lake, because it was good moose country. It was all muskegee and swampy. And the light is falling, and I'm about, 40 yards, 50 yards, looking right across this little bay to my tent, and there's this big dark thing there. And I didn't remember it because I don't know this place. I said, geez, could that be a moose? He's practically standing on my tent. And I looked at it, and it didn't move, and it didn't move, and it's getting darker. And I waited about 5 minutes, and finally it moved just a little bit. The light changed. I said, well, that's a moose. So I raised the rifle, and the first rule of hunting, actually, the first rule of hunting is don't shoot your buddy or yourself. The second rule is don't take a careless shot. We all know that. But what I lacked in judgment, I made up for an initiative, and I fired. And the moose took off, so I had to go all the way back around, and I was chasing it down. I found some blood on the grass, and it was on a game trail, so I ran full speed through the woods, keeping track of where the lake was all the time. Remember where the lake is. And I caught up with that moose, and I finished the job. Don't mean to sound callous, but that's what I was there to do. And the first thing was to locate the lake, and I climbed up on a little knoll, and there it was, right where it was supposed to be. So I gutted the moose that night. Next day, I quartered it, packed it out to the lake, and all I had to do was wait for dawn to come back in. So on about the fourth day, here he came back. Well, yeah, he wasn't going to come back right away because he wants to give me some time to get a moose. He didn't expect one was going to step on my tent the first night. And he's taxiing, and I'm there. Yeah, I'm there. Hey, Don. And he pulls in. He's out on the float. He goes, what did you get? I said, well, I got a nice, fat, barren cow. And he explodes. Just explodes on me. Starts screaming at me. And he unleashed a string of profanities like I've never heard. And the shocking thing is, Don was old school. He never used that language, never used anything harsher than holy buckets or fudgesicle. But he's unloading on me. Get that flipping, zipping, chicken licking, dickin', dickin' thing in the plane. So I take the pieces, and the pieces, as most of you know, are big and heavy and awkward. I'm in the lake, and I'm handing them up on the float, and he's still screaming at me, come on, come on, come on, not moving fast enough. So after about four or five of these pieces, I'm getting winded, my chest hurts, my throat hurts, and I take a little breather. No, get going. He just keeps screaming at me, and I'm getting pissed. I get in the plane finally, we get it loaded, take off, and I'm looking out the window. About 10 minutes go by, and I feel this little tap on my shoulder. I go, what? And he's got this big grin on his face. And he says, well, I guess I neglected to tell you we had switched game units. So I'm man enough to see the humor in that. So we had a chuckle over it. Got that moose delivered. Got the men fed. Got the cabin built. And it's standing there to this day.
You just heard from Steve Durr, who is also a musician in Talkeetna. You may catch some of his music this summer as he plays on the Talkeetna Riverbank in between rafting expeditions.
You're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Our final storyteller for this show is Ray Bain, who says he can sum up his life with one word, luck. He has survived falling through the ice, walked away from three wrecked aircraft, he has been charged by bears, and lost part of his right hand to a dog team accident.
I would like to tell you a little bit about our early experiences in Alaska. I married a girl from West Virginia who I had first met in the seventh grade. We both went on to earn teaching certificates, and we moved up to Point Barrow in 1961. It's been a while. When we went to Barrow in those days, Barrow was a hodgepodge of the ancient and the modern. The houses were just scattered hither and thon. Nobody had any plan of how that village was supposed to fit together. It had just kind of grown up on its own. And consequently, the roads and the trails and the paths all went in different directions, and it was pretty hard to keep track of things. People simply built their homes where they felt, you know, that would be a nice place to put a house. Nobody owned property. When we got there, I began to realize, if I'm going to really see, experience, and enjoy this country, I got to go out like the local folks do. And the local people were traveling at those days in skin-covered canoes, i.e. umiaks, and by dog team. I figured, I got to have a dog team. Now, I had no idea what the heck I was getting into. But I ended up with a group of 6 untrained young huskies that belonged to Bud Helmrichs, who was a big game guide in that area at that time. And Bud had left the dogs in the village for someone to take care of while he and his family traveled to the lower 48. I ended up being that someone. Immediately, I realized I had bitten off more than I could possibly chew. I had no idea on how to train a team of dogs. Now, most sled dogs are actually trained by other sled dogs when they're joined in with a new team. One dog teaches the other dog. I had no trained dogs. Every evening, I would go out to where my dogs were tied, and I would put them in their harnesses, and I would run them out and put them on the sled tow line and run back to the sled to take off. Well, in that little interim, the dogs had all wrestled themselves into a tangled mess. And I was so frustrated that I would tie a line to the front of the team, and I would drag those dogs through the village out over the beach road to get them out of town. Local villagers would come out of their houses and they would wave at me and they would laugh themselves weak at the sight of this bumbling white man trying to be a dog musher. Now, finally, one local villager took pity on me, Eddie Hobson at that time. And Eddie had some really good dogs. Eddie told me, he said, why don't you come on over? He says, I'll lend you 4 of my dogs. He said, I tell you what. He said, you better not put them in with your dogs until you've had a chance to try them out on their own. Okay. Next Saturday dawned, beautiful weather. It was so warm, unlike any day before that at that time. It was warm, it was clear, it was calm. Everybody had thrown open their doors and their windows to let in some welcome fresh air. Okay, so I thought, good day to go and try out Eddie's dogs. So I took my sled and I pushed it on over to Eddie's house. And when I got there, I realized why he told me I better try out his dogs first. They were huge. They looked like long-haired lions. And they were absolutely insane to get into harness. Eddie helped me, you know, wrestle the dogs into their harnesses and put them on their lines. And I ran back to the back of the sled, jumped on, pulled up the sled anchor, and they took off in a dead run. I was barely hanging on, and the one law of dog mushing is hang on. So I'm hanging on. We go whipping in and out of all these village homes. People were scattering out of our way, but we were heading for the beach road, and I knew we were in pretty good shape. At that moment, a loose sled pup bolted across the road directly ahead of my dogs. My team never missed a beat. They made a right turn. They were right on the tail of that dog, and that dog realized death was literally nipping at its heels. The dog squealed in terror as it darted in and out of around the houses. The team was catching up. They were coming close. And suddenly, that dog dove through the entryway of a local village house. It went skidding across the floor, took refuge under the table of a family that had sat down at their noonday meal. My team never hesitated. They went right in after it. Fortunately, the sled was too wide to fit in the doorway. It slammed into the frame. Everything came to a sudden stop. There's that pup cowering behind this, over in this corner. And five Inupiat Eskimos were pasted to the wall at the rear of the room. My reputation was made. Years, decades later, I was still hearing about the crazy Tunnock who drove his dog team into a village home.
That was author Ray Bain, and his book, Our Perfect Wild, documents more of his Alaska adventures.
This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. Thanks for tuning in. To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
Our website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for this show, all of whom are volunteers, by the way.
The proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about this is also at our site.
Thanks to our audio engineer from the Alaska Teen Media Institute, Kendall Stormo, and thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
What will we do when times get tough? Improve our life or play from the rough? I love the start of new things to come. And I love your lips, wanna give me some. Will we fuss and fight when things go wrong? Will we laugh and sing every day a new song?
We'll just have to see what movie we'll be. We can swim or sink in our new beginning. Oh, I'll just let it be. No more inquiring.